and greetings. Welcome to The Dividing Line. It is a Tuesday, and given that I travel on Thursday to Dallas, might extend this one out to, I think we can go to about 11:10. You said you had to leave for that, so we'll see. it'll be a challenge one way or the other, to try to get all in. But, be that as it may, a lot to get to today. I was trying to get stuff put together here real quick. Still trying to grab one thing here that I thought I had opened and I didn't, unfortunately. Trying to remember what, kinds of abbreviations you used many years ago is hard to do, but I thought this would be easy to open, but I do have it on my phone, I suppose if I can't find it on my computer, I can use it on my phone. Anyways, we'll try to get to that. You'll see me since it's hard to hide anything when you have a camera on you looking for something here. Delete that. my files. Modified. Ascending? That's close enough. We'll see if that works. Anyway, people in channel asking for a link to The Dividing Line if they would like to watch if we're still working. Right there on the website, yes. Well, okay. Just telling you what they're saying. If you don't want them to listen, that's okay. You know, it's all right. You know, I understand perfectly. Anyway, couple things to get to today. I'm going to try to tie them all together. It won't be easy to do. Let me go over them and you'll see what I mean. One of the topics that we addressed on the Lost Dividing Line, we've pretty much covered them, gone back over them all, except for one. And that was an article that appeared on Pulpit and Pen, back in September now. This would be September 16th. Nail your confession to Roman Catholic door this Reformation season. It's by the news division, wink, wink, and which is what Pulpit and Pen uses when they don't really want to tell you who actually is writing it. But it is, Pulpit and Pen would like to encourage you to take part in Reformation Day celebration this season by nailing your confession of faith to your local Roman Catholic Church door. Yes, you read that right. And it goes on to have an extensive discussion of the Pope as the Antichrist and things like that. And then a lengthy discussion of how not to get yourself thrown in the hoosegow. Feel free to attack it, the Roman Catholic Church bulletin board. It fulfills the spirit of Luther, but might not be nearly as gratifying. Use a small fishing nail or a tack if you choose to put it on the door. Try not to damage property by any meaningful definition of the term damage. Place it near the crease of the door in the grain so the tiny hole is not noticeable once removed. Fourth, don't do it anonymously. Put your name on it as Luther did. You should provide a short note about why you are doing this. You are still protesting. Be prepared to be charged with a misdemeanor for vandalism. And lengthy discussion of the technical definition of vandalism and all the rest of that stuff. Just a couple thoughts about that. I would not recommend nailing anything to anybody's door, especially because that's not what Luther was doing. Luther's act was not an act of protest. Now, if you happen to be a professor at a university and would like to challenge Roman Catholic professors to debate the nature of grace as seen in the Doctrine of Indulgences, well, okay. Then the modern equivalent of that would be posting such a series of possible debate theses on Facebook or the internet or something along those lines. But that's what Luther was doing. He viewed himself as a faithful son of the church. He did not yet view the Pope as the Antichrist or anything like that at that particular point in time. And this was nothing more than a professor at the rather young, still young and upstart, University of Wittenberg was started in 1510, as I recall, so it's only 7 years, challenging some of the big boys, like the University of Leipzig, where they eventually did have the debate, to engage in debate on this particular subject. So all the stuff that you see right now, especially in October of 2017, about Luther protesting. The term Protestant that comes out of the Second Diet of Speyer in 1529. So you're talking 12 years. We got 12 years before the term protester or Protestant will actually have its 500th anniversary. And that was a technical term. It was a legal term. At the First Diet of Speyer in 1526, the Lutherans outnumbered the Roman Catholics, and so they gave freedom within the empire. The Diet is the Holy Roman Empire. It's sort of a congressional meeting. It might be a good idea to only have Congress meet every few years. man, all of our rights would be significantly more safe, as would our pocketbooks. But in 1526, freedom was given to people in the Holy Roman Empire to allow for Reformation worship. But then in 1529, with Charles present, the Roman Catholics were in the majority, and they rescinded all of that, and they reaffirmed the condemnation of Luther from the Diet of Worms in 1521. And so there was a clause in the legal documents of the empire that allowed for a protest on the part of the minority against the actions of the majority. And so at the Second Diet of Speyer, 1529, these individuals protested the political actions taken by the Roman Catholic majority at that particular point in time. And that's where the term Protestant came from. And it had deeply, heavily political aspect to it at that particular point in time. And it's almost a negative thing that's the terminology that is used today, Catholic and Protestant, given the origination and the background and stuff like that. But that's the reality. That's what it was about. But so Luther wasn't protesting anything in the sense of he saw himself as a faithful son of the church. He saw indulgences as an abuse. He was not alone in this. There were many people who found the indulgence sales, just as so much of what was going on in the church that day, to be exceptionally offensive and outside the realm of the tradition of the church and things like that. And so if you do want to do something for this Reformation season, may I suggest that you do something that would actually be effective. You know, as mentioned in the article, you know, leave a tract on the door. Well, you know, you can roll one of those things up, put it inside the, you know, if it's got a latch on the door or something like that. You can use a rubber band. You can do something that's not going to get you called by the cops for vandalism. But may I suggest making it a worthwhile tract, one that has some meaning to it? I am concerned that a lot of what I'm seeing from my Protestant brethren at this time of year, especially this year, simply repeating mantras and not recognizing that there was something called the Council of Trent, there was something called the Counter-Reformation. You had, you know, Rome didn't sit on its thumbs and do nothing for the past 500 years. So many today have little knowledge of Roman Catholic apologetics and little knowledge of the arguments that they present. And so if you present a very standardized argument that does not take into consideration, you know, Catholic answers and St. Joseph communication and all the rest of that kind of stuff that is out there today, you're not really going to be accomplishing a whole lot. In 1993, we went up to Denver, Colorado, to the World Youth Day. We handed out a track. I was going to show it to you, but we evidently don't have any. But we handed out a track called The Pillar and Foundation of Truth, which was specifically designed to address the claims that were being made by Roman Catholics at that point in time. So it takes their claims and provided early church father citations and all sorts of things like that, that, you know, demonstrated that we too have not just been sitting around since 1517, and that there has been a growth in our understanding of what Roman Catholicism teaches, and we're keeping up with their apologetics and stuff like that. So I'd suggest making sure it's not something like the Four Spiritual Laws, which is not going to communicate anything in that context. You might want to find something a little more relevant at that point. Speaking of which, I listened to it was actually called a debate. It was supposed to just be sort of a testimony type thing. But I found it interesting that, you know, years and years and years and years ago, I've told the story many times, the phone in my office rang, and we had to change the number just recently. We had people calling, and this was back in the days of cassette tape answering machines. Okay, so we're talking a long time ago. And so we'd actually had the number changed, and this the number phone rings, and I pick it up, and there's this jovial voice on the other side that says, "Hi, I'm Chris Arnson of WMCA Radio, and I'd like to talk to you about coming out to New York to do a debate against Jerry Matatix." And it gets quiet for a second. The first thing I said was, "How did you get this number?" "Oh, well, I think Bill Webster had given it to him, if I recall correctly." And so given that Chris ended up organizing 10 what were called the Great Debates that went on for a decade, and other debates besides that. I mean, my first debate with a Muslim, I don't consider it my first Muslim debate, as I've said many times, but my first debate with a Muslim was organized on Long Island. And the debate with Sabin from the Oneness Pentecostal Church, that was also put together by Chris. So Chris put together a lot of debates on Long Island over the years. And we arranged that first debate, and that was with Jerry Matatix. So we did the Marian dogmas, we did Sola Scriptura the next year, and then we did Pacua and the papacy, and St. Genis got involved, and Madrid, and you know, pretty much everybody. And so it's ironic, after all of that, I started going overseas in 2005, and I forget when I was first on the Unbelievable radio broadcast with Justin Brierley. But lo and behold, just recently, Chris Arnson was on Unbelievable. Chris is a former Roman Catholic, and that was sort of what had gotten all that started, because he was at one of these get-togethers where Catholics and Protestants talk. That's an interfaith dialogue. Oh, no, that's what led to all those debates and all those Roman Catholics being saved. Anyway, Chris went on with the guy was an Anglican who became Roman Catholic. Sorry, in England, that's not that big of a jump. It really, really, really isn't. If you're sort of a liberal Anglican, you become Roman Catholic. I'm sorry, that's not quite the same thing. But anyway, a guy named James Bogle, who's a barrister, a trial attorney. And, I guess the camera's over here now. Hi. I've been ignoring you all, looking off in the other direction. They went on, and it turned into a mini debate. Obviously Sola Scriptura and issues like that. There were a tremendous number of straw men thrown out by Mr. Bogle. And Justin's already said, hey, you know, next time you're over, you know, we could do round two. And I'd be happy to correct all these straw men, but I'll just be perfectly honest with you. You know, just as there are Muslims at different levels of debating ability, there are Roman Catholics at different levels of debating ability. And in comparison to Peter D. Williams, Mr. Bogle was, I would just like to think that, that Peter would not have made some of the really basic level misrepresentations that James Bogle did. But who knows? But what I wanted to play for you is just one little section, because I listened to it on a long ride on Saturday, and I was listening to this part, and I was just like, this continues to be said over and over again, but it's something we need to be prepared to respond to. If you're going to engage with folks, be prepared to respond to it. So here's what he had to say. This will be a short one, but here's James Bogle. And listen to what he says at this particular point.
If we're going to say, well, the gospel arrives with Luther, throughout the history of Christianity, there is a sort of remnant somewhere who believe what the Protestant reformers believe. Where is this remnant? Where is the evidence of it? The answer is there isn't one. There were no people. Perhaps you might say the Lollards or someone, but before that time, from the very beginning of Christianity, there were no people believing what people like Luther and Calvin, Melanchthon, and the other reformers believed.
Now, what was interesting was the next thing queued up on my iPod was the I got about halfway through the new book called Long Before Luther, which is specifically on the early church representation and witness in regards to issues regarding salvation, wherein they did agree with Luther. So I found that particularly interesting, that kind of statement would be made at that particular point in time. But what also cut in to my thinking at that point was, you can't possibly have ever listened to Luther or read any of Luther to come to the conclusion that Luther thought he was a revolutionary, that he was presenting something absolutely novel that no one had ever believed before. If you seriously take the time, you will know that, for example, Melanchthon, to whom Luther sort of committed a lot of, at least a portion of the defense of his position on a scholarly level. He had extremely high views of Melanchthon's scholarship. Melanchthon, a very young man, 21 years old when he began teaching Greek at the University of Wittenberg. But Melanchthon often is citing from John Chrysostom and Augustine and other people like that in the early church in support of the Lutheran position. And even in a later time in history, at what's called the Marburg Colloquy, which we'll get into at a later point in time, Melanchthon and Luther are citing from patristic sources in defense of their position over against the Swiss reformers. So even in inter-Protestant, inter-Reformed dialogue, Calvin, he had done his degree in ancient legal literature. So these people knew the history of the church very, very well. And we're not sitting there going, we don't care what anybody before us believed. We've just come up with this on our own. Their stress was upon the apostolic nature of sola fide or sola scriptura or whatever else it might be, but they viewed themselves as clearing away excess tradition. They did not sit there and go, we've come up with something brand new. They believed that there had been many before them who had in fact believed in these things. And so when you talk about Sola Scriptura, that's why you have the three-volume set from Bill Webster and David King. You've got The Infallibility of the Church by Salmon. You've got Whitaker's work. You have so many of these major works that thankfully are still available, well, have been put back into print, really, to be honest with you. They've been put back into print only over the past number of years, but they had fallen out of print. But serious interactions with historical sources and things like that to deal with the teachings of the early church and the development of or de-evolution of dogma over a period of time, things like that. So it just struck me that Mr. Bogle has never done serious reading on the other side. That pretty much all of his argumentation sounded like he was reading from Catholic Answers, but not from both sides at the same time, which is not unusual. It's unusual. I mean, we have people on our side that, like I said before, if you just repeat the old mantras, you don't really keep up with what's going on. That's going to be the result, and it's a bad thing. So, what does all that have to do with our where we're going today? Well, it is the 10th of October in 2017, and there is a great deal of conversation going on right now regarding the Reformation. And it's not from my perspective that I need to get in on that. I mean, I spoke about it a lot while we were in Germany, standing there on the bus, giving bus lectures and speaking at incredible places. I mean, the video won't be available for a few months, but eventually we'll have the video up from Michael Fallon and the team at Sovereign. And so you'll get to see lectures recorded at the Wartburg Castle, at Fritz Erbe's cell in the South Tower at the Wartburg Castle, at Worms with Josh Weiss, at the Reformation Monument at Worms, where I gave a small 5-10 minute presentation, and especially the sermon at the Castle Church, the Schlosskirche in Wittenberg. So that stuff will be out there. So I don't feel any particular compelling need to add to the stuff that's already there on that level. But what I do want to do is, I'll just be perfectly honest with you, I'm a little concerned about the way in which the Reformation is being presented by many, even people on the right side of things, sometimes present what can only be seen as a cartoonish view of the Reformation. And we're certainly not the first generation to do it. If you spend some time in the Luther house in Wittenberg, you can see how even toward the end of Luther's life, and certainly in the decades afterwards, there was this hyper exaltation of Luther's bravery at Worms and things like that, and the elevation of Luther to a position that historically really shouldn't necessarily be where we would go. And so, you know, I understand that a comic book style story of Luther is pretty much all most people have. How many non-Roman Catholic individuals today, how many quote-unquote Protestants today have actually read a meaningful biography of Luther? Even Roland Bainton's Here I Stand, even reading that would give you so much more of the historical background. Very, very few people. And so as a result, we are really left in a difficult situation In the sense that I think a lot of people, if you embrace a false narrative of the Reformation and then you encounter the truth about how much politics was involved, and you encounter the truth of the fact that Luther had his character flaws and Zwingli had his history and his background, and then you look at what at the fact that this was a magisterial Reformation. And what I mean by that is this is a Reformation of the state church, the issue of sacralism, or some people call it Constantinianism, where you have church and state connected to one another. When you have that kind of thing, a lot of people become disillusioned. And I don't want to see that happen. I want to see an accurate understanding on the part of people. And you might say, well, you know, I'm more interested in apologetic information regarding Islam or something like that. Okay. I really think that there is a need, even if you're dealing with something which seems as separate as Islam, to have a good, solid historical understanding of where our own modern-day denominations came from, if for no other reason than to give an explanation as to why we differ from one another. But also, Luther, for example, had a Quran. Luther had a fascinating eschatology. This really freaks a lot of people out who think there's only one kind of eschatology. But Luther had a fascinating eschatology where he had a physical antichrist and a spiritual antichrist. And the physical antichrist were the Muslims, because Europe was at war with the Turks. And they were threatening to overrun Vienna and overrun Europe itself. So, he had the spiritual antichrist, of course, was the papacy. Eventually, it wasn't, you know, you have to figure out where you are in Luther's life to figure out what he's focused upon at that particular point in time. There's no question about it. Anyway, so I want to spend some time, between now and, you know, we don't have to stop on October 31st. I'm going to be in Washington. I'm going to be traveling to Washington on the 31st. And, you know, October 31st, 2017 should be seen as the beginning of really more than a decade of consideration of what happened 500 years ago. I honestly think that there are dates more important than October 31st of 2017. I think the Heidelberg Disputation, the Leipzig Disputation, Diet of Worms, and then coming up in 2025, the 500th anniversary of the Peasants' Revolt, huge impact on Luther's thinking. And then you've got to look at the Marburg Colloquy, the production of the Augsburg Confession, and then a few years later, you're looking at the conversion of John Calvin, and we can start looking at events in Calvin's life. And I think if I'm still around by then, you know, if I have a normal lifespan, if I live as long as my dad has, I should be. We should have a big old celebration of the night that William Farrell came to Calvin's room, and put the fear of God in him. I think that would be I'm not sure how we do that celebration, but it would be fun. And so all sorts of things we can be doing, but it really. There has to be a foundation laid. And so I would like to start by going back and pointing out that Luther didn't just pop into existence. There were There's some great movies. When I got back to Germany, I watched the 2003 Luther movie and was shocked it's a 2003 Luther movie. I thought it was a lot more recent than that, but 2003 is not that long ago, I guess, but for some people it is. Anyway, real good movie up to the Wartburg Castle, and then after that it just goes all over the place. It starts squishing events together and stuff, and up till then it's pretty accurate. And then after that it just went loopy, but I guess they had to get it into a certain amount of time, and that's what they had to do. But on YouTube, you have Martin Luther Heretic, the BBC, right at an hour. Really, really good video to watch, especially this time of year. And so you look at those two, and in both of them, John Staupitz, Luther's father confessor, at Erfurt. Extremely important in directing Luther in the right direction. What do you do with people like that? What do you do? I've been teaching through church history at PRBC. I talked about some of this on Sunday morning. What do you do when you have people like Staupitz in history? What do you do with people who lived before what we would call a great clarification of biblical doctrine on certain topics? Do you hold them to the same standards we hold people to today? Is there a difference between ignorance of something and willful rejection of something? So many people want to project our modern situation backwards into the distant past and force people to be judged on the basis of things that they had never even heard of or conclusions that were arrived at long before they were alive based on information they never had access to. And so this is one of the things that I really took umbrage with Dave Hunt about was his willingness to read the hearts and minds of men and women that lived long before he did. And Dave was pretty old, but they still lived long before he did. And to engage in an exceptionally surface level historiography. And I don't think we are fair when we do that. We are not going to want to be judged in that way. And so we can't do that to others. So what we need to understand, and sometimes people aren't willing to do this because, well, you know, I'll listen to the story of Luther, but that's pretty much all. I don't want to do anything more than that. You know, okay, maybe Calvin or something, but, you know, just give me the highlights. Well, the problem is you get the highlights, you're never really going to understand why people did what they did. And if you, for example, want to have any idea whatsoever about what happened with Miguel Servetus in Geneva, you can't just jump into that and judge Servetus or Calvin or the Swiss Cantons or Luther and Melanchthon, who were also involved with Melanchthon was not Luther, but the Lutheran movement. You can't judge them by modern standards. If you do, you're going to end up really not believing there was almost anybody who was a Christian before our modern day, which is an untenable position to take. And so what you have to do is you have to look backwards and recognize what happened prior to Luther coming on the scene to have some idea of why people believe what they believe. For example, no one at this time period could even give serious thought to the idea of a free church, because when you were born in such and such an area, you're a Christian. The tax rolls of the state were the baptismal rolls of the church. And it had been that way for about 1,000 years. And so it had always been that way. No one could remember a time when it was anything different. And we look at the 30 years war, and we look at all that, this tremendous, you know, we look at Luther hiding in the Wartburg castle, and it says, Rome's terrible to try to kill him and use it. And 10 years later, Lutheran states are imprisoning Anabaptists. Why? I just can't believe that Lutherans forgot. Luther is hiding from the political state, and then 10 years later, he's willing for the political state to persecute other people. How could you do that? Because he was a sacralist. Because he was a sacralist. And you, as a non-sacralist, are looking back, and judging him on a foundation that he didn't have. And it's really easy for you to say, well, he should have. But I just go, would you have, if everyone for 1,000 years before you had believed the same thing? I mean, it's really easy for you to claim you would have. I don't claim that for myself. I don't know what I would have done, but how far would I have gone? Would I have had the bravery they had? I don't know. But so much came before that ended up creating the soil out of which the Reformation started. And I've said in many of my presentations, if I had been choosing who to head this, who to function as the match, or it's someone had well said that it's like the man climbing a bell tower in the darkness, and he misses a step, and he begins to fall, and he reaches out for anything to arrest his descent, and he ends up grabbing the rope to the bells, and ends up wakening the entire town because the bells are ringing at a ridiculous time in the morning. Well, that's what Luther was doing. Luther was not trying to do anything. He reached out and ended up starting something he didn't intend to start. And I would have chosen so many different people. Luther was not the systematizer. And certainly, when you look at Luther at Marburg, you're not all that impressed with his incalcitrance and the fact that his incalcitrance was primarily motivated by politics. So, lots of things to be extremely, extremely thankful for regarding Martin Luther. And so much truth and so much gospel insight. And yet, other things where you sort of go, I mean, obviously I would look at someone like Wycliffe and go, oof, there's a scholar for you. Oh, man, there's a systematizer, and ooh. But it wasn't time. It wasn't time. There were certain things that had to be in place for the Reformation to be the Reformation, for it to be something other than merely a political movement. I mean, when you think about it, there had to eventually be a breakdown of Rome's monopoly over religion in Europe. But why did it have to be a religious breakdown? In other words, we can be extremely thankful that the Reformation was focused upon the true gospel, a biblical gospel, a strong and powerful proclamation of justification by faith. And we can be thankful for that because the breakdown of the Roman hegemony in Europe could have been very secular. It could have been a collapse of all type of spiritual faith. It could have been very different. But for that kind of Reformation, the Reformation we ended up with, for that to exist, certain things had to come together. And some of those things did not exist in the days of Wycliffe. For example, you had to have the printing press. You know, for 200 years, Martin Luther held the record for the most published works. In other words, the number of copies. For like 200 years. We have pamphlets from Martin Luther today. With even our modern scholarship, we can't tell who printed them. We don't know where they came from. That's how secret they were. That's how good at keeping a secret they were. Because it was illegal. But this was how the word was spread. You had to have printing. And in the West, anyways, printing with Gutenberg's movable type is middle of the 15th century. It's not quite a full century. It's about 80 years after Wycliffe's death. Now, Wycliffe's ideas still spread, but they can only spread so far because they have to be handwritten. And so his ideas spread to Bohemia and to Jan Hus. And Jan Hus would have been a great person, but again, just too early. It was too early. Because you had to have printing, and you had to have the Renaissance. There had to be a rise in literacy. There had to be a rise in the universities. There had to be that great Renaissance phrase, ad fontes, to the sources, which is what drove Desiderius Erasmus to learn Greek and to then desire to make available a Latin-Greek diglot called the Novum Instrumentum, which, as you probably know, he did in 1516. And it was only a matter of months after it came out before a copy found its way into the hands of the fairly new professor of theology at the University of Wittenberg named Martin Luther. And having the Latin and the Greek on facing pages and being able to compare what's one with the other, and the first few Greek dictionaries coming out and things like that, very, very important. Didn't exist for Jan Hus. Didn't exist for Wycliffe. And it had to be not just for the leaders of the movement. It had to be for, well, when Luther goes to the Wartburg Castle, hiding from Charles after the Diet of Worms, one of the things he does is he translates the Bible into German. And Lutheran schools start cropping up all over the place. And what is their focus? But literacy, reading, with a focus primarily upon reading the Bible. And this didn't exist in those days, in the earlier days. So you had to have the printing press right around the same time as the invention. The printing press, you have the fall of Constantinople, and so you have all these scholars fleeing from the Turks into Europe, bringing their manuscripts with them, which then become important in the production of Erasmus's Greek New Testament. A couple other things that had to happen. One that I've mentioned that a lot of people don't think about. The Crusades had been going on for hundreds of years. They had a tremendous impact upon Europe in many ways. But you combine the people that were lost in the Crusades, the soldiers that would leave and never come back. You combine that with the Black Death, 1347 to 1350. The Great Mortality, as it was described at that time. And it's rare that you hear somebody say, well, you know, the Reformation sort of required that plague. A lot of people describe the Reformation as a plague, but it was in the background because so many people died. When I was in seminary, The number we were given was one out of every three people. I read a couple of books before going to Germany. And the modern books, in some areas, will be as high as 70%. So many of those would say, on average, to the whole population, 50%, one out of every two people. Talk about thinking that the world's about to end. Many people believed exactly that, the world was about to end. You couldn't blame them for thinking it. And some forms of the plague, you know, we believe it was the bubonic plague, but there were, like, there was a lung-based version of it. The regular plague would give you, well, it was about, there would be a very small number of people that would survive it, maybe 10 to 15%. The form where it started in your lungs, there was no recording of anyone that survived it, and generally, from the time it first manifested to your death was about 18 hours. 18 hours. That's why some people at that time actually developed the theory that you could contract it merely by looking in the eyes of an infected person. Because, you know, if it can kill in 18 hours, you can understand why people would come up with that idea. And by the way, horrible, horrible aspect of the Black Death at that time. See, despite Al Gore and all the radical leftist socialists of our day who are trying to convince us that your SUV is killing the planet, the temperatures in the world have changed down through the centuries. And historians have known for a very, very long time that there have been these warming intervals and then cooling intervals. And a warming interval has started around the beginning of the 12th century. And it lasted most of that century, which had allowed for the utilization of land much farther north to be put into cultivation than had been available for centuries. We know this to be true for many reasons, but there are, for example, towns in England that are named after vineyards that you can't grow grapes in today. We know that when they were founded, you could. You can't anymore, which means it's cooler today than it was then. So much for your SUV. But that warming trend began to break down, and a distinct cooling trend began. Had nothing to do with nuclear weapons. Again, mankind, nothing to do with any of this. But started at the beginning of the 14th century. And there had been a real population increase. If you can grow more food, people have more babies and you have more people. And there had been a real population increase. Now all of a sudden, a lot of people are right on the edge. And when you have populations living right on the edge, these are populations that are very subject to plague and to disease and things like that. The theory is that the cold in the Russian steppes drove these, not rats, but the original carriers of the bubonic plague farther south into the trade routes, and hence brought the fleas first into Muslim areas, and many people were in Muslim lands were impacted by the plague. And then in late 1347 into Sicily and then up into all of Europe, England, et cetera, et cetera. And people did everything to try to avoid the plague. They didn't understand what we understand today. Every scientific treatise that I'm familiar with, whether it was written by Muslims or Christians, that dealt with the plague included astrological information, because people on both sides of that theological divide recognized that there had been a rather important conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter, I believe in 1345, which was supposed to portend great changes in the world. And there are, I'm pretty certain there's a papal document pointing to that same conjunction in 1345 as having something to do with the rise of the plague in 1347. There is a lot of astrology in that time period. But what's fascinating to me is, as far as I know, the Muslims never blamed the Jews for the plague, but the Christians did. And I forget which Swiss town it was. It might have been Zurich, somewhere near a lake, so it's probable. It might have been Geneva. I don't know. I've forgotten. I could look it up. But the story began to be circulated that the Jews were poisoning wells, and that the poisoning of the wells where the plague came from. Well, that was stupid, because the plague was ravaging cities that were completely dependent upon rivers that didn't even use wells. So it didn't even make any sense. But under torture, Jews would confess. You know, it's really easy to get people to confess to things when you're torturing them. And so this one city actually took all their Jews and put them out on an island in a building and burned it down. Killed them. And it's fascinating to me, sad to me, that at this point in time, the Muslims didn't come up with that idea, but the Christians did, quote-unquote Christians did. But what does all that have to do with the Reformation? Well, simple. Let's take the figures I was given of one out of every three. It was probably higher than that, but let's just take that as a low number. What happens if one out of every three people in a society disappears? Well, economically, the guy down at the bottom, who is just a laborer, all of a sudden his labor is worth a whole lot more, because good luck finding somebody to work your land. You got to have somebody do it. So all of a sudden, he can make a whole lot more, and the people can afford to do so. Why? Because if one out of three people disappear, all of a sudden, you got all this money, and it wasn't, back then, it wasn't a credit economy. See, you've got all this money, you got all this gold, property, and there's only two-thirds as many people to possess it now, which means pretty much everybody gets a big fat raise. And so the plague was one of the many things that led to the rise of the middle class and broke down the feudalism of the preceding centuries, which had been so destructive. You know, you had universities beginning to be founded 12th century, but to have many universities and to have enough students to actually really substantiate them, you need to have a middle class. And the plague was very important in producing a middle class. Most people never think of it along those lines. Also provide us with a nursery rhyme that no one will ever use again after you realize that's what this is about. But ring around the rosy, pocket full of posy, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. We all held hands and danced around in circles, celebrating the Black Death. Yes, that's where it came from. Black Death. That's where it was all about. Was they would dance around these poles. They would carry pockets full of posy. Ashes, ashes. We all fall down. We all die. Some of our childhood things are extremely dark when you actually look back at what gave rise to them. But it was, yeah, mm-hmm. It was pretty amazing. Very important in bringing these things about and in as part of the background to the rise of the Reformation. So you have the printing press, you have the Renaissance. One other thing, you have the rise of nationalism. The rise of nationalism. And why was this important? Well, if you watch some of those films, you will see some of the crowds turning on. Okay, welcome back to the Dividing Line. We crashed for a while. Not sure how long we will last this time, but we're just going to go a certain amount of time and just do the best we can. Apologize for this. We've got software issues and stuff like that, and may have to go to a different software company for streaming stuff in the future because the one we're using isn't working for us. But I was in the midst of discussing the Black Death, and from what people are telling me in channel, I was talking a little bit about the fact that there had been a warming period that had resulted in a great increase in human population, and that we know this had happened because we can find cities in England named after vineyards and things. We know there had been vineyards there. You can't grow grapes there. It's too cold now. But at an earlier period of time when it was founded, you could. And so we know there was a period of time leading up to around 1300 where you had warmer temperatures. Even in places in Greenland and Iceland, there were places where you could cultivate crops for a period of time, which you cannot any longer today. So it was warmer back then. Then that started changing. And you went into a colder period, beginning at the start of the 14th century. The theory is that the natural hosts of the rodent type animals in the Russian steppes, the natural hosts, were driven by the cold down into the trade routes from China. And through those fleas, this is how the disease vector made it into Islamic lands, and then from Islamic lands into Christian lands, starting in Sicily, late 1347, and then really hitting in 1348 across all of Europe. Now, a couple of things. Some people feel that the plague did not hit Islamic lands as hard as they did Christian lands. And the reason's simple. Muslims in that time period had a much higher hygiene level than people in Christian Europe did. And I'm using the term Christian Europe as a historian here, not theologically speaking. Sadly, I mean, obviously, it's called wadu. It's the cleansing, the ritual cleansing before the prayers. There is bathing as a part of normal Islamic hygiene. Did you know that, for example, Catherine of Siena, one of the great mystic women of this time period, that one of her great claims to fame and spirituality was she never bathed. Never. And an average person would go for a year without changing their clothes in Europe. I just sort of figure your olfactory nerves just burned out by the time you were three. So after that, it was like, yeah, whatever. It makes me go, ugh. But you need to remember our modern level of hygiene and deodorant and showering, real modern thing. So the Muslims had the advantage because they were cleaner, just physically cleaner at that point in time. But one other negative thing is that the story began to develop in Europe that the Jews were behind the plague, that they were poisoning wells. Well, it was absurd. The plague began in places where wells weren't in use. You were dependent upon rivers and things like that, so poisoning wells would be irrelevant. But under torture, certain Jews admitted to this, and so Jews were driven out of town. They were killed. One city in Switzerland took all of their Jews, put them out on an island in a building, and burned them. So many Christians blamed Jews. What's interesting is the Muslims never did. As far as I know, I could be wrong. If you want to prove me wrong, prove me wrong. But as far as I know, at this time period, the Muslims did not come up with the idea of blaming Jews for the plague. I can think of a lot of Muslims today that would, but they didn't back then. So something to keep in mind. Well, what happens as a result of the plague? Let's go with the numbers I was taught, which are conservative numbers, that one out of every three people disappear. What is the result of that on a culture? Well, if you're just a manual worker working a farm, working out in the fields, all of a sudden your labor is worth a lot more because they've got less competition. Less competition, prices go up. But at the same time, if you have a fixed amount of stuff, this isn't a credit society as yet. So if you have a fixed amount of gold and a fixed amount of land, and all of a sudden one third of everybody disappears, you now still have the same amount of stuff, but you only got two thirds the number of people, which means everybody gets a big raise. And what the Black Plague actually helped to do was to give impetus to the rise of the middle class. And that middle class was vitally important because universities, which had been founded earlier than this, to have lots of universities and to have universities flourishing, you got to have students. And the middle class has always been, you know, there's only a certain number of upper class hooty-tooty people. The middle class has always been, you know, where you'd get your students. And so the Black Plague was very important in the rise of the conditions that allowed for the Reformation to take place and to destroy the medieval serfdom situation that we had at that particular point in time. So you have that. And then lastly, you have the rise of nationalism. Up until this point in time, you'd view yourself as a member of the Holy Roman Empire that happened to live in Germania or amongst the Franks or in Italy or whatever else it might be. Borders began, and they remained, European borders have been all over the place for a long time. But you started having this is especially important in our story, an identity of German nationalism, French nationalism. And if you watch the movies, you'll see a time in both of them where Tetzel is preaching indulgences and the crowd starts going, we don't want our money why should we give our money to go build St. Peter's Basilica? If we're going to give German money, then let the money stay in Germany and build a basilica in Germany. And Tetzel responds, are Peter's bones in a basilica in Germany and blah, 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 blah. But you cannot really underestimate the power of the political aspect of nationalism that helped protect Luther. Rome moved slowly against Luther, and part of the reason was she would have moved much faster, only a few decades earlier. But the politics of the day, the death of Maximilian, the election of Charles, all the power vacuum or the power politics between the Pope and France and all that kind of stuff. Very, very, very important in what happens in the Reformation. And so we can't forget this stuff. We can't forget that the world is just coming out of a period of anachronism where only a couple hundred years later, earlier, people would paint pictures of David. And David would be riding a horse, wearing armor, living in a castle. And we go, ha, 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 today. But that's what people thought. Because the average medieval European never traveled more than 7 miles any one direction from where he was born. It's a small circle. It's a small world. And if that's all you've ever seen, then you know what a king is. So King David must have been like the king I have. And so we see this anachronism. And this was, by the way, this is also important because this is what allowed the papacy to gain such power. The documents, like the Donation of Constantine, the Pseudo-Isidorian Decretals, these things are laughably anachronistic to us today, but people in that day did not think in such ways to be able to recognize anachronism. And when people started thinking that way, when the Renaissance comes along, when people like Lorenzo Valla start critically looking at texts and going, this is supposed to be from the 4th century, but it makes reference to stuff that actually didn't come about till the 8th century, so that means it's probably a fraud. That was dangerous. That was almost considered like witchcraft. Now, be careful, because what happens is we who use these things, you know, think these are the, you know, or we were wedded to these, it'd be sort of nice, we could have it surgically implanted or something. We are so accustomed to being able to just use this and grab information and stuff like that, that we think so highly of our technological advancement that we think very, very poorly of those who came before us. And when we realize they engaged in anachronism, then these people must have had IQs half of ours. No. No. These people could concentrate for periods of time that almost none of us today can. Almost none of us today can. If most of us were thrown into a situation to try to survive on what they survived on daily, we'd die. The amount of knowledge they actually had, given the lack of educational system, was astounding. And in many ways, I would say that the average IQ was higher because there was less distraction. So be careful. It's real easy to go, they thought David was over. Well, the only reason you don't know that is because someone told it to you a long, long time ago. If you had grown up in the situation there, would you have been brilliant enough to have thought that out? Those are some of the questions. So there's some of the background that's so very important to an understanding of what gave rise to the Reformation. We only have a few minutes. We had a technical issue and had to restart the stream and stuff, so we've lost part of our time. But I do want to just briefly run through some of the pre-Reformation reformers as well to help with some of the background. And yes, I will be covering all of this in the Church History series at PRBC sometime next year. We just didn't time it real well to fit with the October 31st thing. But and not everybody who watches or listens to the program follows the stuff at PRBC and vice versa and things like that. So there you go. When you talk about pre-Reformation reformers, most of the time you start with someone like John Wycliffe. You could go back. History just it defies the simplistic categories that we often try to force it into. It really does. We have men like Gottschalk. People who tried to emphasize Augustinian theology during the medieval period. Were they pre-reformers? They got in a lot of trouble. Gottschalk certainly did. It's hard to say, but most of the time, when historians refer to the pre-Reformation reformers, they start with John Wycliffe, 1328 to 1384. He, interestingly enough, my understanding is that in his own handwriting, we have 12 different ways of spelling his last name. In his own writing. Now you might say, what's that all about? The idea of standardized spelling had not developed yet. Young people, you cannot use this as an excuse. You don't live in the 14th century. Okay? But you do need to know that the idea of a standardized spelling system, grammar system, especially in English, had not yet developed at that point in time. So if you see the Wycliffe Bible translators, you see it spelled, you know, W-Y-C-L-I-F or W-Y-C-L-I-F-F, W-Y-C-L-I-F-E, W-Y-C-L-I-F-F-E, W-I-C-L-I, there's just all sorts of ways of doing it. And Wycliffe would not have cared one way or the other, which is nice. He taught at Oxford. Oxford University had been founded earlier than that time period, of course. And he was a priest who pastored at a parish called Lutterworth. He worked to get rid of immoral priests, a common problem in England of the day. He received his doctorate in 1372, which means he only lived 12 years after receiving his doctorate. Receiving a doctorate could kill you. That's sort of how that worked. And in 1376, he published a book called On Civil Dominion. And once again, the reality is that very often, I can't think of an exception in European, English, even American history, where politics didn't have something to do with Reformation movements, religious movements. Very frequently there is a necessary, sometimes not necessary, connection between politics and religion. So he writes a book on civil dominion, a work that was very favorable to the crown and civil government over against papal intrusion. Now, normally, when I'd be presenting this material, I already would have gone over both what's called the pornocracy, the low point in the Roman papacy in the 9th and 10th centuries, and then the huge rise in papal power that had taken place in the 11th and 12th centuries, and the constant conflict that existed between church and state because of sacralism. Sacralism was the default. So what do you do? And so he had taken his stance with the king over against the pope. By 1378, he began publishing his doctrinal perspectives with pamphlets that attacked certain Roman Catholic beliefs. He began by stating that Christ alone, not the Pope, is the head of the church. By 1382, only 2 years before his death, he was opposing the entire doctrine of transubstantiation, having recognized that it was a theological novum, that in his day, dogmatically, it was less than 200 years old. But again, you have to research to discover things like that at this particular point in time. he held the concept of sola scriptura, though he did not utilize that specific phraseology. He said the Bible, not the church, is the sole authority. In his book Trialogus, written shortly before his death, he wrote these words, quote, "Therefore, if there were 100 popes and all the friars were turned into cardinals, their opinions in matters of faith should be believed only insofar as they are founded in Scripture." Well, that's sola scriptura, whether you use the term sola scriptura or not. He taught that the entire Christian faith was to be found in Scripture. And because of this, and this becomes very important, because of this, he felt that the people should have the Bible in their mother tongue, for every Christian was duty-bound to study it. Now, you need to understand, literacy rates were extremely low. And so Protestantism has always been an educational movement. I mentioned earlier the Lutheran schools. Always the idea of possessing the Word of God. And hence, we have been the ones who have been the primary force behind Bible translation, Bible distribution, and the teaching of reading, so that you might possess the Word of God and read the Word of God for yourself. It's all connected together. Wycliffe used the term sola gratia in defining his doctrine of justification, grace alone. He repudiated the distinction between bishop and presbyter, which needs to be repudiated because there is no distinction biblically between the two, even though, of course, again, by Wycliffe's day, it had been a distinction that had been believed for 1,000 years. Maybe a little less than that. So how could you question such a thing? Well, if you believe the Bible is the ultimate authority, then you test even what you've been believed for 1,000 years by what's found in Scripture. He repudiated the excessive worship of images and relics, the proliferation of ceremonies, superstitious pilgrimages, and the external observance of rites in general. He finally repudiated the veneration of saints as well. Now, again, it might be real easy for us today to go, well, of course, we repudiate the same things. But again, it's impossible for you to put yourself back into that time period and to recognize what it took to do what these men did. It'd be very, very difficult. And how far would any one of us have gone? Don't turn these people into cartoon characters and exalt yourself by saying, well, I've done. Okay, so Wycliffe repudiated these things. I would have, if you had just, you know, as long as I could read the Bible, I would have seen all that stuff myself. Okay. If you want to think that, you go to it. I happen to know enough about history that I'm not sure I would have. And know enough about myself. So, Wycliffe was summoned to Rome a number of times, and many papal bulls were hurled against him, but England was in no mood to cooperate with Rome in the first place, this particular point in time. Again, politics. And in 1378, the Great Schism took place in the papacy, the Avignon papacy, the Babylonian captivity, which would divide the papacy into two and eventually into three before it was finally healed at the Council of Constance in 1415. And this obviously keeps Rome just a little bit busy. They can't concentrate on Wycliffe any more than Leo X could concentrate on Luther only a little over 100 years later. Wycliffe began a translation of the Bible in English that was condemned by the Roman Church, and copies burned all over England. Why? Well, it's real easy to just simply paint Rome as the great enemy of the Bible, but it was an ecclesiastical thing. It was dangerous. They really believed that that it was dangerous to the spiritual health of Christians to have direct access to the Bible. And how did that come to be? Maybe we'll wrap up with this, and then we can, well, next time we'll talk about the Lollards and go on to Jan Hus. But how did that happen? How does something like that, how do you go from the apostolic period to now here at the end of the 14th century, and it's like, well, the Bible's a dangerous thing. We can't have people reading the Bible. That wasn't a straight line. When we were in England, I'm sorry, when we were in Germany, every church we went into had these astoundingly beautiful stained glass windows. Well, I was raised to think stained glass is a bad thing. But I happen to love color, so I've always secretly loved stained glass. You know, the light that comes through it and how it, you know, on a cloudy day, it looks different than on a bright day, and it looks different in sunrise and in sunset. Oh, you know. And what you have to realize is during the low point of the Middle Ages, where even the majority of the clergy are illiterate, they had to find some way of communicating the story. And while the sermons became shorter and shorter, became sermonettes and just simply storytelling, you ended up telling the stories of the faith in the windows, with images. And that was the only way people knew. You'd point up there and see what's happening there is this, and this happened there, and that happened. And was it wrong to tell the biblical stories that way? If you're going to go that far, you're going to have to say that children's Bible story books are wrong. You shouldn't have children's Bible story books. You just give them the King James Version. If they can't read it, big deal. Just listen in church. There are some people that will go there. Okay, well, whatever. Eventually, what happens is the leadership of the church becomes quite accustomed and takes advantage of the fact that people are totally dependent upon them for their knowledge of what is in Scripture. And now it's used negatively, not to communicate truth, but to protect falsehood, because there have been doctrinal developments during this time period, and they're not positive doctrinal developments. And so almost everything that we can object to today started from a good idea, with good motivations. But things change. Things change over time. And Wycliffe recognized that in his day, things had gotten pretty bad. Pretty bad indeed. And so the people needed the Word of God. You couldn't trust the corrupt clergy to be the ones to communicate this. People needed it. That's why he does his own translation. Not from the Greek, but from the Latin Vulgate. So the Greek translation would have to await a later time period. But the point was possession of the Word of God in your own language. Radical thing. But it started a movement called the Lollards. We'll talk a little bit more about them next time around. So wrap things up, and we will leave time in future Dividing Lines for current events and things that are going on, but I do, as we have opportunity between now and the time of the Reformation and immediately thereafter, there's nothing magical about October 31st. Make sure that everyone has, hopefully, a fair and grounded understanding, because it is important to so many things, because each one of us has been impacted by these developments. If we don't know the history, then we don't know how we've been impacted, and we can't filter that out. We have to know to be able to accurately analyze our own position. So hopefully this has been of use to you. Lord willing, we'll see you the next time on The Dividing Line. God bless.